My honor and pleasure to I don't like the word interview, but have a chat with Amy about some of the issues that she raised in her really excellent address tonight, but also about the issues that Democracy Now is so associated with, which I admire so much about it. Amy, the media is, as you made clear, is absolutely crucial to literally Democracy Now. I was at a conference in Sweden with Susan Faludi and Edward Said, and Susan said something that the audience found quite shocking. She said that there were only, she felt, six people in the mainstream with the independence, but not necessarily the will, to be independent journalists and broadcasters in the entire United States. She said that as she went around colleges talking to people in media colleges, she found that most young people didn't want to be journalists anymore. Now, it's my experience that journalism and youth usually go together. There's a wonderful mixture of idealism and so on. But they wanted to be PR people, marketing people, image-related people. Now, this is shocking. Is that how you've seen it, or is there another side to this?
Well, there's no question that now around the country, even in journalism schools, there is a larger and larger department of public relations. They're joining them together. But I really think, just traveling around the country, that there is a grassroots movement, or many grassroots movements in the country, that are more powerful than the corporate media realizes, that's under the corporate media radar screen. I mean, you look now at the indie media movement, the independent media center movement that really just burst on the scene with Seattle. With people there, 50,000 people taking the streets saying no to the World Trade Organization, but also included in their ranks were hundreds of particularly young people who took their pens and pencils, their video cameras and their tape recorders and said, we're not going to view this global uprising against corporate power through a corporate lens. And they set up indiemedia.org, and as CNN.com and CNN were reporting no rubber bullets were being used, we were picking up gobs of these rubber bullets, and indiemedia.org was telling the truth about this. They got more hits on that website than CNN. People came to understand that there has got to be another way. So whether people want to go into corporate media, I don't know. I actually thought it seems to them to be a very glamorous job, because people aren't even journalists anymore. You've got, right, the actress of NYPD Blue is now one of the anchors of CNN. People, you know, they're tested, audiences are tested, body tested to how they're responding to the women on the screen, and that's how you get chosen, whether it's good journalists or credentials. So maybe the thing, they don't have to go to journalism school anymore. You know, it is frightening what's happening with the media. I just read a piece in Advertising Age that said they're now moving toward the spotless hour, which means not breaking for commercials, for spots. Now you think, oh, this might be PBS, except now PBS does have commercials. They're going to go with an hour. This is commercial media. And instead of going to those commercials where people might cut away, they are doing product placement. It's very smart, actually. Product placement from top to bottom. And they know then that it will be much more sort of incorporated into your subliminal consciousness. And they'll even have storylines around the corporations. I don't think around that Coca-Cola is having unionists killed in Guatemala, but, you know, people working in a plant or something. I think it is very much underestimated where people are today. I think that it is not the silent majority, it's the silenced majority, that the media is only expressing this minority elite and people are appreciating that, and that more and more people are doing a kind of grassroots journalism that should be acknowledged and that is trickling up.
Is there a situation now in the United States where the developments that you describe will lead to something, not the same, of course, but something similar to the beginning of what used to be known, when I lived in the United States, as the movement in the 1960s. I'm not saying the same, but it seems to me, I mean, I share your optimism about grassroots action, although I also have a healthy respect for the ruthlessness and pervasiveness of power. And I think we must be careful not to sometimes persuade ourselves with our own optimism. That allows us to drop our guard, perhaps. But I do agree with you about that. And I was just wondering if the pervasiveness of what is called the anti-globalization movement, what I would call the internationalist movement throughout the world, is such that it could, although it began in the developing world, the poor world, could it become a movement with Seattle that has happened and other before and since September the 11th, other expressions of this, could it become something like that again here?
I think there's no question about that. I mean, I think that the various movements in this country, environmental movement, anti-nuclear movement, gay and lesbian movement, human rights movement, I think that we should be calling them a pro-democracy movement, just as we do in other parts of the world, but we don't sort of frame it that way here. And on the one hand, you have the pervasiveness of the so-called war on terror. But there's a response to that. I mean, it is what the corporations and states are very afraid of. You've got tremendous corporate globalization, but there's a grassroots globalization that could be much more powerful. I think if you look at what's going on now in the occupied territories, and I really want to get your view on this, but this one movement, a lot of people coming from the United States, though other places, the international solidarity movement, has done something quite remarkable, and has, as the Israeli military cracks down on these communities, the occupied territories, they could try to stop Palestinians from being heard around the world, or they could discredit what they're saying, and they have this vested interest, right, in living. It's been harder to deny what people from around the world, young people in the United States, are saying. They can't stop them from describing it. And those people, amazingly brave, putting their lives on the line. In fact, John, John has just returned from the occupied territories, and maybe you could share a little of what you've seen there in just the last weeks and how much hope you see and how much, and whether or not you see the situation as hopeless.
Oh, no situation is ever hopeless. Of course not. That word doesn't exist. I mean, the inspiring thing always is you. I mean, I was just thinking, as you described earlier, what you saw in Timor. And I have to say, when I went to Timor, I didn't think in my lifetime that there would be an independent East Timor. I didn't think there would be a post-apartheid South Africa, for all its faults. I didn't think there would be that in my lifetime as well. So, you know, we're not exchanging false hopes and optimisms here. These things happen. I do believe there will be an independent Palestine. I think one of the But we can't afford to wait much longer, because we'll have soon, and we're having already, a kind of East Timor situation where a ruthless establishment, now in charge of the Israeli state, backed by a ruthless White House in this country, will make life so terrible for Palestinians that their road to independence will be a very bloody one and a very suffering one. I say that because I believe that, just listening to what you were saying about the shield, it's in the United States, where the source of power in the world, but the source of good power as well, that the hopes of Palestinians really reside. Because until the incredible bias politically and in the corporate media against the Palestinians is turned around, it's going to be very, very difficult for them to achieve their independence. Having said that, they will achieve it. The extraordinary thing is to go to places like Gaza, which is like an open prison surrounded by electrified wire, where over the last few years, thanks to the Clinton peace plans, the Oslo peace process, the majority of people in Gaza and in the West Bank are now, according to the World Bank, down to living on about $1.50 a day. They're amongst the truly poorest in the world. A grinding poverty now. People who had work no longer without work. All those related scourges now with it, domestic violence, the effect on children. I saw a survey in Gaza done by the United Nations that said 90% of Palestinian children now suffer a serious trauma. I talk to children who dream of nothing but death. Children. Now, we shouldn't be surprised, but we don't hear about them. And the assault on this society is something that must end unless the society itself, unless the society itself becomes so damaged that it will take many, many generations, as it probably will in East Timor, for it to recover, as it did in Cambodia after Pol Pot. But above all, in the United States, the perception that reigns here of victor and oppressor, which has been reversed, and I'm not saying there are not victims and there are many victims, but basically, politically, historically, the victims are the Palestinians. Until that's reversed, and people in this country, which has so much influence in that region, nothing will change. Nothing will change until the Palestinians, in their desperation, try to take their own independence. But I just don't believe they should go through that, that agony. So that's a feeling I have, having been there, Amy. I mean, as you mentioned in your speech, and you come from an Orthodox Jewish background, one sometimes feels in places like New York that even to breathe the name, the word Palestinian, is to invite a very hostile reaction. I mean, am I seeing it too much in a kind of black and white terms?
I think it's very important, especially for Jews in this country, to speak out. I wasn't raised as an Orthodox Jew. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi. And I was raised, though, in the deeply questioning tradition of what I thought was a Jewish tradition. When I was a kid, I went to Israel and visited my family there. And when I, in 1988, when the Intifada began, I went back as a reporter and was horrified to see the symbols that I held dear growing up, like the Magen David, the Jewish star, hanging over a tank, because that is what the Israeli flag is, and that's when the state and religion come together. How could those symbols of peace and that came to mean to me social justice come to mean militarism, war, and death to a people? I really encourage people to read the books written by Norman Finkelstein, who is a very important academic in this country, who has been driven out of almost every university he's spoken in. He is the son of Holocaust survivors. His latest book is The Holocaust Industry. And it is very important, as I was saying in the talk, about the issue of standing up so that next to people who get targeted, so that they won't be taken down alone, to read and discuss and talk about the experiences of others and open our eyes to what's happening in Palestine and Israel. We just interviewed Myla Goldberg, who is the best-selling author of The Bee Season, about spelling bee, a Jewish American young woman. And she spoke out very fiercely about the occupation and said she's appalled when she goes to synagogues and community centers about what young Jews are saying about Israel. She just says, open your eyes. Have you ever spoken to a Palestinian? It is very, very important that we break the monopoly that the Jewish establishment has on what the acceptable point of view is on Israel in this country. There are many Jews, as there are in Israel, I think you've found from interviewing people, who feel differently. And if their voices are heard, and the media serves simply to amplify, if those voices are heard both in Israel and the United States, I think very quickly the dynamic will change.
I mean, as we're starting to run out of time, I wanted to ask you a more general question. You've said that it's incumbent on all of us, meaning all Americans, of course, to pressure Congress and the president. Why? If the system is so closed, the corporate system, so politically corrupt, and corrupt in many other ways, why is it
important to pressure them?
Yeah. Why, in other words, is it still worth bothering with them? I ask that because there's a subsidiary question to that. And I think it's one.
You're going to have to take one of these questions.
Anna, this is the heat is on. There seems to me a whole debate that has to happen around liberalism. It seems to me that people can no longer look at conservatives as the enemy. We know who they are, but that it's often liberals who are, in a way, the enemy in disguise. Now, okay, this is not a new subject, it's a very old subject, and it's been talked about for a long time. But at election time, there's a kind of political and emotional blackmail, and it happens in other Western democracies, in what I would call single ideology states. And our energies are directed towards almost reinforcing that single ideology state and without moving on. In other words, without attacking power really at its heart. Is that just something you could comment on as the red light is on in about, if you can do it, in, well, no, forget the red light, just comment on it.
Well, first of all, I agree that I think that lines are breaking down between conservatives and liberals. And I actually think that that provides some hope, because in the McCarthy era, maybe it was a little different. And I do think we're going into something like that again. But there's a big, big difference. And that is that conservatives also are speaking out against, for example, surveillance and monitoring, speaking out against these supranational organizations like the World Trade Organization that are overturning the laws of democratically elected legislatures for corporations. They don't like privacy invaded either. And I think that there's a kind of new coalition building that we should be very aware of and not be quick to label people. The corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats form a united bloc, and they're the main parties in this country. When I interviewed President Clinton on election day of, that led to this election of Bush, the thing that made him most angry was when I said, I said, why shouldn't people vote for Ralph Nader? I said something like, isn't it really your fault taking the Democratic Party to the right? And he said something like, I find you hostile, combative, and at times disrespectful. So I said, well, then I just have two more questions. But
what an accolade. Come on.
It's very important. I asked him about the death penalty, why he went back to execute Ricky Ray Rector in the first election. He took a day off from campaigning to go back and execute this man who was mentally impaired, to say the least. And at the end of that, he said something like, which is why you should vote for Hillary and Al Gore, and so, but therefore the death penalty too, you know, as opposed to the Republicans. And he said something like, but they know what the issues are, which, of course, I think is what you're getting to, but that makes it worse. Because you're saying, you know, the people who act like they're liberals, they say one thing, but they do another, but they understand. It doesn't mean anything to me to understand. It matters what their actions are. These are actions that have reverberations around the world. And on the issue of elections, you know, we both know well, as I think all of you do, people die for elections all over the world. They die to go out and vote. And here, most people don't vote. I mean, whether you had the guy who was selected, Bush, or you have before that, Clinton, less than half the population went out to vote for them, went out to vote. And about a quarter of the population votes for any of these presidents. So that's hardly a mandate.
You know, the corporate media says, and this the same thing applies now in Britain, which is Blair was elected with the lowest turnout in British electoral history, and it was reported as a landslide. The corporate media always says the people are apathetic. In fact, what happens is, in my view, is that people go on strike. And I think that is, it seems to me, it always seemed to me, that is what happened in many ways in this country, that people didn't see federal politics, presidential politics, of having any relationship with their lives whatsoever. And they walked away from it. Others simply went on strike in disgust against it. And I think that's probably what happened. Has happened in recent years.
And voices are getting out. The marginalized majority is what's out there, not a minority of people who are on the fringe. I think a lot of you are probably a part of this. And it is very important that your voices be heard. And I don't think we should feel they thrive on us being disempowered, on us being apathetic, on us not voting. That's how these people got into power, so they're not going to try to change it. But I think they also know, you know, there is that sleeping giant there. They know it because Gore isn't president. They know that people are angry, and they don't see the Republican or Democratic parties as representing them, and New Mexico is very big in this way of having third parties and having a very significant voice that can continue to grow. And I think that it is critical, and I don't know how much of a tradition there is of independent media in Britain, although I think it's interesting for you to talk about your experience working in the commercial media, that we very, much take seriously independent media and its power if we bring it together. What makes it weaker is local is important, but we have to unite, connect the dots. But we really can make a difference. People need to hear in Maine what people are doing in Hawaii. Everyone doesn't have to reinvent the wheel when they have protests. When there was a pro-Israel rally in Washington, there were 100,000 people, they said. I don't think there were that many, and we shouldn't call it a pro-Israel rally. We should call it a pro-Sharon rally. A week later, there was a, you could call it a social justice rally, very much advocating for peace and justice for the people of Israel and Palestine. There were more than 100,000 people. Almost didn't get a mention, but it did get it in the alternative media, so we have to strengthen the alternative media so that the rest of the media is forced to respond. Media is the way most of the people now in the world come to understand the rest of, in this country, come to understand the rest of the world. And so we have to take it over. I don't think it's just about Congress and just about pressuring president and Congress members, though that matters. That little call really does make a difference. We have to be marching outside of the New York Times, outside of the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, NBC, CBS. They have become the major powerhouses, both as corporations in the world, but also as shaping the view we have of others in the world that determines people's action or inaction. I think that's, and National Public Radio as well, and PBS, we have to hold them to their original mission in public broadcasting, and the others, we have to demand that they, well, either that it all become public media, or that they start including the voices of people all over this country and not just put retired generals on the payroll, but opened these studios to the voices of the majority.
Well, as I am in the very uncomfortable and uncharacteristic position of being a chairperson here, I suppose I have to say that that's probably all we have time for. And I think just on ending on the words of Amy's, which were as ever inspiring, as ever made just good common sense, political common sense, moral common sense, that I know this is my first trip to the United States since September the 11th, and it's lifted my own gloom, and certainly being here tonight, being amongst you, and especially listening to Amy has done that. So thank you. Thank you very much.